Hi, this is Susan Smith Nash, and I'm here this evening to talk to you a little bit about best practices gaps. This is part two. I hope you caught the first one. This series, and there will be a third part to this series, just in case you're wondering and feeling unsatisfied at the end of this one. I hope you don't feel unsatisfied, but on the other hand, it's always good to be restless and wanting more, especially when it comes to knowledge. Isn't that right? Anyway, so I'm here today to talk a little bit about the gaps that exist between best practices and benchmarking and what goes on in the wild, in the real situation, in real institutions, and how sometimes some gaps emerge that are in reality very, very difficult to, one, detect, and two, to fix. So, this article addresses those gaps and the actual conditions and results of distance and flexible learning in higher institutions of higher learning. So I'm going to focus mainly on problems that emerge in the production of courses, curriculum, and instruction, and also in the area of faculty support, training, and mentoring. So first, let's look at quality courses. So the best practices concept pretty much states that the learning organization has an academic and instructional plan which has been developed, reviewed, and approved by teams consisting of teaching faculty, subject matter experts, and governing and executive faculty members. Instructional strategies adhere to generally accepted principles of online and distance instruction, and they rest upon a solid foundation of theory, practice, and experiential research knowledge. Sounds good, huh? Have you ever seen that really happen? Well, of course. Of course we have. We've also seen it not happen. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what happens when you have some phenomena that I will call cookie cutter courses. I say that these happen when it's necessary to develop courses quickly, efficiently, and at the lowest possible cost. And when those considerations become the most important, rather than providing the flexibility required in order to produce a course that is not just a bundle of information, but a true learning experience. And I know no one likes to say that when they develop a template, they're running the risk of creating a cookie-cutter course. Or even if they are, they're saying, well, what's wrong with uniformity? Well, nothing. Nothing is wrong with uniformity if the learning outcomes work that are achieved and the learning activities and the learning experience are consistently positive and appropriate to the subject matter. And, you know, I'm here to say that I think it's pretty difficult to apply exactly the same template to a math course, for example, as a writing course. But you'd be amazed how many people and places try to do that. Another thing that happens in the quest for expediency is the unwitting production of training and not higher education. So, problem solving, analysis, synthesis, and critical thinking skills are cornerstones of higher education, and the various stated outcomes that one finds in college-level courses display these skills. However, it is easy for colleges to fall into the trap of producing an e-learning experience that requires little or no actual synthesis of information, and which does not make connections from one discipline to another. Further, courses often fail to provide scaffolding for more future courses. You're saying, well, how on earth does that happen? How does one fail to have any kind of sense of sequence or scaffolding? It happens when courses are produced higgledy-piggledy in this sort of random order, instead of clearly mapping out a curriculum with a kind of instructional design notion of ascending difficulty or scaffolding or preparation, you know, without any sense of where there's a big picture or any picture at all. Another gap occurs because flexible delivery modes should stress multiplicity of modes. However, it is easy and tempting to succumb to an all-or-nothing approach and to offer courses in only one delivery mode. However, learners need flexibility in order to accommodate their lifestyles and the reality of work, travel, access, and schedules. Thus, institutions must be able and willing to offer not only face-to-face instruction, online and hybrid, but also variations that include CD-ROM and PDA or Pocket PC for mobile computing. Content should not be confined to the visual, but should also incorporate downloadable audio, such as in MP3 files or podcasts, such as the one you're listening to now. Isn't this fabulous? Okay, you don't have to agree. Another gap can occur when there is a lack of a plan or coordinated instructional strategy. Because many institutions find themselves playing catch-up, they are often scrambling to deliver what students say they want, or at least what they wanted 6 months before the institution tried to play catch-up. And in that situation, institutions lose their ability to plan effectively, and they find themselves correcting mistakes made because of moving too fast and without a coherent, well-mapped-out, and coordinated plan. And it's amazing how much time and effort is spent in correcting mistakes and undoing nightmares or redoing things over and over and over because of bad planning. Another gap occurs when people jump on the latest delivery mode bandwagon even when it's not appropriate. Institutions waste time, money, delivery efficacy, and faculty competency when they jump onto a trend without doing a thorough needs assessment, SWOT analysis — SWOT, if you remember, means strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats — or a clear analysis of their capabilities and capacity. As a result, institutions have found themselves trying to produce and deliver streaming media classroom lectures, synchronous chat, whiteboard lectures, interactive video game-based simulations, even when neither they nor their students have the A, bandwidth, B, computing power, or C, access to really be able to do it. And this does not even begin to touch the problems of instruction in that sort of environment with such high power needs and such steep learning curves for instructors. Another problem is that at-risk students are left behind. The online environment can be a sink or swim world where only the hardiest and the most adept learners stay afloat. And if you've ever tried taking online courses, you'll find this is really true. And you also have to have quite a tolerance for ambiguity and frustration, which is not really necessarily the case for at-risk learners. It's also important to accommodate all learning styles and to understand the real environment and conditions of learning of at-risk students. It is not simply a matter of making things ADA compliant. It means creating instructional strategies and activities that build community and camaraderie, and they do not require extreme technical skills, which give, and so this is a way to give individuals multiple ways to do the same task. Really need that flexibility. Students need to be able to, on demand, accommodate their own learning styles. Another gap occurs when people are not willing to conduct objective periodic program reviews. The successful launch of an online program is usually accompanied by a huge sigh of relief, coupled with a state of near catatonia or post-traumatic shock syndrome over the next few months, even years, as faculty, staff, and information support seek to recover from the shock of close encounter with disruptive technology. However, this fails to take into consideration that the nature of disruptive technology is to change the way that people think about tasks and how they approach their tasks now that the technology has changed. In order to be successful, it is imperative that one continue to look at one's goals, vision, mission, and desired outcomes, and to determine how those have been affected by the technology and the delivery approach. Finally, let's look at faculty support, capacity, training, mentoring, compensation. You're going, ooh, those are painful topics. But we have to look at those because we have to think, okay, in best practices, it is stressed that faculty members teach and develop courses in areas where they have demonstrated expertise, experience, and/or leadership. When asked to instruct courses, faculty are, in a best practices situation, provided support, training, and guidance in a proactive manner. Compensation is fair, and intellectual property issues are settled in a manner that is mutually agreeable. So the faculty and situation is that, and it sounds pretty utopian, right? Does this ever happen anywhere? I mean, we all know that we'd like this to happen, but things fall apart and gaps occur when, for example, there's a failure to provide timely and appropriate mentoring and training. So not only do institutions fail to provide mentoring and training, they also fail to require instructors to undergo the training. They don't put any teeth in the penalties. So in failing to do that, they do the instructors a disservice, particularly in a world that is increasingly dominated by a class of distance professors who have taken the time and effort to equip themselves with the latest equipment and skills to be effective online and multi-modality instructors. So they've bought their Palm Pilots, they've bought their pocket PCs, they've bought their laptops, they've invested in high-speed internet connections, they've invested in software, they've bought their their arms, and they're out there using them. That's just the way it is, and it's extremely important that universities recognize this phenomenon. Some people would call it self-sufficiency. Some people would call it a class of mercenary professors that can, in the long run, destabilize the structure of institutions of higher education. And whether that is good or bad, it's yet to be seen, but we need to recognize that this is a huge factor. gaps occur in best practices when there is a failure to review faculty credentials and evidence of growth. In part, I would say this is a legacy of a tenure system that allows professors, once tenured, to become complacent, to retire on the job. Now, okay, maybe that's a little cynical. But I have to say it's probably also a case of expediency. It is not easy to find professors who are early adopters or who keep themselves up to date with technology. They invest in themselves even when nobody else is willing to invest. They put money in themselves even when their department can't, won't, whatever. So, I mean, it's hard to find those. I mean, it's a unique set of circumstances and personality traits. So what happens is the professors who do this can be good facilitators, but are they staying current in their subject matter? Or are they continuing to inform themselves of best practices and effective methods to achieve desired learning outcomes? These are good questions. My personal feeling is that if an institution requires evidence of growth, they have an obligation, an ethical obligation, to support that materially, philosophically, and psychologically. Finally, flexibility can become rigidity. This is a paradox that is, unfortunately, not uncommon. Institutions that start out being flexible by offering students the opportunity to take online courses may, in fact, overnight find themselves extremely rigid because, well, they've invested in software and hardware that constrict them. For example, they may have invested in a learning management system they've locked in for 5 years, can't stop. They've gone to a notion of templating courses without any ability to be flexible, and then they have a one-way-only instructional design subject matter expert model for developing courses. Then they become rigid because they require the professor to teach in one certain way rather than being flexible, and which they're really basically accommodating the technology rather than learner needs. So this is kind of the crux of the matter. Flexibility becomes rigidity when the technology dominates rather than the actual interaction between the students and the professors, and where there's a potential to mediate that learning space. And in my opinion, the key thing is to keep the e-learning space mediatable. Okay. Hey, Susan, what do you mean by that? What I mean by a mediated learning space is that it gives people the chance to modify it, adapt it, make it flexible, to accommodate all sorts of variables, not just learner needs, but also crashes or issues with the technology, with the content matter itself, with world events, with people's lives, making connections between real life and the content, placing it in the appropriate context, validating experiential learning. It's all quite interesting. Anyway, we will look at more soon. This has been a long podcast. Thank you for your patience in listening to it. It has been fabulous to spend time with you. And as a faithful minion of the e-learning queen, I am accompanied by my fellow workers, the instructionally designing cats. And I'm here to tell you that I enjoy every moment that I spend with you. It is a pleasure and an honor and a privilege. So thank you for listening. You've been listening to Thoughts on E-Learning, the E-Learning Queen. Bye.